Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. 25 years ago, documentary filmmaker Bruce Weber released his movie Let's Get Lost, a kinda sorta documentary about jazz trumpeter and singer Chet Baker. I'm hedging a bit because Weber didn't exactly go the dispassionate observer route. For example, he dragged the aging, addicted Chet Baker on a night-long car ride in L.A. as part of the shoot. In just a bit, we'll talk with Bruce Weber about the making of that film, and he'll share a playlist that includes Chet Baker and a few surprises. Also, have you ever wanted to know the lyrics to a song and look them up online? Ever wonder if those websites with all those lyrics are legal? Yeah, me neither. But guess what? We've got another online copyright battle brewing. But let's start by wrapping up this week's question. As you may recall, the folks at Spoonbill and Sugartown Booksellers in Brooklyn noticed that their music collection was kind of dude-heavy. So they sent us an email asking for suggestions of great books by or about women in music. We came up with a list. You can see it at soundcheck.org. But we also wanted our listeners and guests to weigh in. Anne wrote in with two suggestions. That Old Black Magic, she writes, chronicles Keeley Smith's rise during the golden days and nights of Las Vegas. That book, by the way, also features her co-star Louis Prima. Tom Clavin was the author. Anne also goes on to suggest Patti LuPone's A Memoir. It includes stories of both singing and acting her way through New York. And this suggestion came in on the Soundcheck Listener Hotline.
My name's Deborah. I live in Newark, New Jersey. And when I was 12 years old, my mother, who was a university librarian, got a book for me. And it was on the extraordinary musician, Wanda Landowska. She was the lady who pulled Johann Sebastian Bach out of the museum, and it reintroduced Bach's music to contemporary performers. And that meant so much to me. So that's my recommendation.
Wanda Landowska not only revived the music of Bach in the early 20th century, she made the harpsichord cool again, or at least audible again. Her biography, Landowska on Music, was co-authored by her companion, Denise Restu. So there's something for everybody in our list of recommended books about women in music, and, as it turns out, joining me now is one of the women whose career is in one of the books on our list, Kathleen Hanna. She was the leader of the so-called Riot Girl movement in the 90s with her band Bikini Kill, and later led the electronic-tinged group Le Tigre. Now she's back with a new band called The Julie Ruin, and they'll play live for us in a moment. Kathleen Hanna, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, thanks so much for having us.
Now, do you have a pick to add to our ever-growing list?
I guess my favorite one would be The Sound of Soul by Phyllis Garland, which might be a little hard to find, but it's totally worth it.
And what kind of period or scene is that?
It's about soul music, like the origins
thing?
And where it came from. And
wow.
Yeah, but it was, I believe it was written in the 60s or 70s, so it didn't go up to like the 90s or anything.
Okay, so it's like some pretty classic soul.
Yeah.
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 And Phyllis Gardner?
Garland.
Garland.
Like a garland on a Christmas tree.
Phyllis Garland. Okay. That's one that no one has mentioned yet. You want to keep going?
Well, the other two are kind of like self-promoting, but, you know.
Go ahead.
But they were, of course,
plug away.
I didn't write them, and I'm not getting money off them, but Sarah Marcus's Girls to the Front, which is about the Riot Girl movement, and then the Feminist Press just put out a book called The Riot Girl Collection, and it's pages from fanzines from the 90s, Riot Girl-ish type fanzines, and there's all different things, some about music, some about political issues, but it really does relate back to the music scene. And it really kind of shows how many different opinions there were, and that there wasn't, it wasn't just Bikini Kill, and whatever a Bikini Kill record was, that was what Riot Grrrl was.
Right.
You know?
So the idea that there wasn't just like one brand of feminism, and there wasn't one brand of girls in music, and
exactly,
stuff like
that. Exactly. And like each page is color, like reproduced. And it's just such a beautiful, gorgeous thing. And typically, as feminist artists, we don't get these like beautiful this coffee table yet intelligent books.
So this is new.
Yeah, it is new.
Okay.
It came out just this year.
Give me that title. The Sue Marcus book is on our list already.
Yeah,
so.
It's called The Riot Grrrl Collection, and it was put out by the Feminist Press. And okay. Johanna Fateman, my Le Tigre counterpart, actually wrote the introduction. So
all right.
I'm very proud of her.
So there are three new additions to our ever-growing list for the folks at Spoonbill Books in Brooklyn, books about women in music. Kathleen Hanna's here with her band, The Julie Ruin. There's a story behind the album and the project, but why don't we, you want to hear a song? Why don't we do a song first?
Whatever you want.
I want a song.
Well, it's kind of fitting that we're talking about Riot Grrrl because this song is about sort of, you know, getting older and then being like, what would the younger version of me think of the version of me now? And what does the version of me now think of the younger version? So,
all right. The song is called Goodnight, Goodbye.
Yep.
And we'll hear Kathleen Hanna singing. Let me introduce the rest of the band to you. Sarah Lando on guitar. Kathy Wilcox, also ex-Bikini Kill, playing the bass. Carmine Cavelli is behind our drum kit. Kenny Melman is manning the keyboards. And the song again called Goodnight, Goodbye is from the band The Julie Ruin. Here it is, live on Soundcheck.
Goodnight,
The Julie Ruin is the name of the band, led by singer-songwriter Kathleen Hanna, live on Soundcheck with a song called Good Night, Goodbye. The Julie Ruin's album is out now. It's called Run Fast. Kathleen, you said going into that song that it was sort of like, you know, looking at the current you, wondering what the old you would make of what you're doing now, and vice versa.
Yeah.
I mean, you can only imagine what 21-year-old Kathleen Hanna would think of you now, but what do you think, looking back at, you know, the Kathleen Hanna who cut such a big figure in the music world in the 90s?
I mean, I just look back and see how scattered I was, like how I had way too much going on, and, you know, it's so easy to look back and see the flaws, like, I overpromised stuff and then resented people when they expected me to do too much stuff that I promised I would do. And, you know, all the kind of stuff that anybody who gets older looks back and thinks of. I don't really look back and be like, whoa, I was a massive monster legend. I can't believe it. But I do, you know, I have a, there's a movie about me called The Punk Singer coming out, plug, plug, plug. And, in it, I watched Bikini Kill footage for probably the first time, and it was pretty insane. Like, I never really understood what people were talking about when they were like, whoa, you guys are so crazy live. And I was like, oh, really? Because it felt totally normal when we were doing it to me. And then I watched it. It was like, whoa, that's intense.
But even Kathy here on bass, who is in the movie and was in Bikini Kill, even she is on camera saying it was like, crazy, the live performance.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff that happened to us was really crazy in the way the audience reacted, but I never understood why we were getting that reaction until I watched the footage, and then I was like, wow, we seem like just a whirling dervish, like Tasmanian devil machine, like crazy, so.
All right, so what do you think whirling dervish crazy Kathleen would make of you now?
I think she'd be completely shocked. I think she'd be...
Why?
Just, you know, I never expected that I would still be playing music this long. And I think I kind of thought I'd go into a life of activism and leave music behind. And
Well, you know, there was a time, there have been years. I mean, this is your first album in, what, 9 years?
Yes. Yeah.
We have... You know, I mean, I saw you at a rally on Foley Square, I think it was last summer.
Yeah.
So you've been politically active, but not so musically active.
Yeah.
And at least part of that is because of Lyme's disease,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But you didn't know you had it for a long period of time.
No, I started getting really sick in 2005 during Le Tigre's, like, world tour, and it was just, like, kept getting sick once a month over and over, and I just couldn't keep saying, oh, it's because I'm older and I'm touring, and it just really went downhill from there, and doctor to doctor to doctor to doctor, and I'm sure you've heard it before, because a lot of people have it, and once I mention it, people are like, oh, yeah, my cousin, my aunt, my friend, you know, I know 5 feminist performance artists who have it. Like, wow. How random is that?
And, you know, the story of John Laurie of the Lounge Lizards.
I don't.
Also has been, I mean, just like completely off the scene for exactly that reason, advanced Lyme disease.
Yeah.
So where are you now in that?
Well, I'm done with my most intense treatment, which was 9 months of IV antibiotics that were like basically pumped into my heart.
Wow.
Yeah, that sucked. But now I'm still on a oral antibiotics, like, thing that I do, and I have 3 more kind of difficult treatments, and then I'll be on maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm, you know, just, I don't want to say taking it day by day, because that just sounds like day by day. But I am just, you know, I have good days, I have bad days, I have days where I'm really exhausted, and days where I feel fantastic. Luckily, I'm doing okay today.
Yeah. But the whirling dervish?
She's back.
She's back. All right. You know, we heard that you had donated your personal archives to NYU's library a couple of years ago. I guess that would have been when you were sort of like really in the depths of this. Were you actually thinking, hey, maybe I should be thinking about
mortality?
Yeah,
exactly. I mean, when you have an illness that is like, you know, starting to get to be arthritis, and I can't make it up the stairs, and I'm in bed for weeks at a time, and I was having a lot of language difficulties. you start really thinking, I don't want to leave a bunch of stuff for my friends to have to do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And the really positive side of the whole thing was I had to learn how to ask for help. And a beautiful thing happened was that I just went on, I think it might have been like the La Tigre blog or something, and I said, I need help. I need some interns. And immediately got an overwhelming response from younger people who were like, I will work for free. I will help you with whatever you want. And none of them knew that I was ill at the time, but they showed up for me, you know? And that was really a powerful feeling.
You know what's interesting in what you just said? You didn't say a bunch of young women. You said a bunch of young people.
Yes.
Are there like younger guys who were like seriously into...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, what's funny is that... I'd mentioned earlier Sarah Marcus's book, Girls to the Front, and,
right.
You know, Bikini Kill, part of what we would do is we would ask the girls and women to come up to the front so they could see us playing.
Right.
Because it's like, why are we playing feminist music if nobody can see how easy it is to, you know, move your hands on the fretboard and...
And part of this upcoming documentary is like, shows you sort of, you know, shunting the boys to the back of the bus, so to speak.
But the thing that happened is that a lot of the cool guys didn't, you know, get mad about it. They all went to the back.
Right.
So I didn't even know they were there. And now that they're coming to the Julie Ruin shows, they're coming up and being like, oh, yeah, I was at every Bikini Kill show, and I'm a big fan, and I'm meeting kind of all the cool guys who were like, I always understood it. I always understood that... Even though it wasn't directed at me, I could flip the words from the pronouns to be about something I was experiencing. And that's something that so often women have to do is, you know, change the pronoun of something so that it affects them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so often what gay, lesbian, and trans people have to do is change the pronouns. And it was really great to have guys say, I was fine with that.
Wouldn't it be great if all our problems could be fixed simply by flipping the pronouns? Wouldn't that be great? So, you know, when you felt good enough to come back to playing music and to, you know, playing this music, you had your you could have gone the La Tigre route. You could have even maybe, you know, tried to revive a sort of Riot Girl thing. What took you back to the Julie Ruin project, which was a solo project that you'd done?
Well, I mean, they both came out of really bad depression. Mm-hmm. Like, I was really depressed because I was sick and physically depressed. I mean, I was, like, physically very ill.
This is 97.
This is, like, in 97, I was leaving Bikini Kill.
Right.
And I was super depressed because the band was breaking up. It was my whole life. It was my whole identity. Didn't know who I was. Also, you know, I got known as the difficult woman, you know, from the band, and I was a man hater and all of those feminist stereotypes.
You were all kinds of trouble.
Yeah, I was all kinds of trouble, and I felt like I'd really been pigeonholed. And then when I wrote this record, it was to help me sort of find out who I was again, away from being, you know, the difficult woman in Bikini Kill. And then I got really sick, you know, 20 years later, whatever, and I was like, okay, I'm going to do something to bring me hope again. And I was in that similar place of, like, looking for hope, looking for who am I away from this sick person?
Mm-hmm.
Because I had become, you know, it was 24/7 for me dealing with the illness. That was my job. That was all I was able to do. And I started being like, is this just who I am for the rest of my life? Is this who I am? And the only way I ever saw the Kathleen I used to know was when I was singing and playing music and writing with my friends. And the great thing was this time I didn't have to hide away in my apartment by myself singing vocals in the closet. I brought my friends in and people who I cared about, and we collaborated together on making something. So,
and is that the band here today?
And
are your friends?
These are actually some stunt doubles that I hired. But no, these are the real... The real deal.
Well, let's put them back to work, shall we?
All right.
All right. We're talking with Kathleen Hanna and hearing the band The Julie Ruin. Their album is called Run Fast. It is out now. And Kathleen will take up her position behind the vocal mic again, Sarah Lando on guitar, Kathy Wilcox on bass, Carmine Cavelli on drums, Kenny Melman playing the keyboards. They are The Julie Ruin, and this song is called South Coast Plaza, live on Soundcheck.
We lay in an empty treehouse. I'm not sure what drugs we were messed up on at the time, but we were laying next to each other in a treehouse in your backyard in Orange County, talking smack, smoking cigarettes, drinking California coolers. We were gone, 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 gone beyond all sense. He was staring, he was squinting at the sun as it came streaming through the slats. You reach your fingers out for mine. I don't know what we were feeling at the time, but it was summer. I think it was summer. The time you held my hand, we held on to the floor as it went spinning through the air. We knew the world was ours.
We laid an empty tree out in that backyard in Orange County, and we made the kind of pact that you just never think. Never think you'll have to keep. We laughed even as we made it, and then we moved on and we started talking about gym class gossip. We were gone, gone, gone beyond belief. Then we got bored and we drove around for a while, went to South Coast Plaza and had a taco and some ice cream, and then we passed out in the car. I don't know what we were feeling at the time, but it was summer. Pretty sure it was summertime. You held my hand, we held on to the floor as it went spinning through the air. We thought the world was ours. We lay in an empty treehouse. I know you already know this, buddy, but I didn't want to have to do it. But that pillow and your aching were bound together and collided in that treehouse in Orange County. And we had known each other far too long. We had known each other far too well. And I thought we'd grow old together laughing, squinting at the sun. So you know, I'll never go back to South Coast Plaza. And you know, I'll never go back to Orange County. And you know, I'll never let you slip my mind.
I don't know what we were feeling at the time, but it was summer. Pretty sure it was summer. Time you held my hand, we held on to the floor.
We didn't know it at the time,
but it was spinning us apart. It was spinning us apart.
The Julie Ruin, live on Soundcheck with a song called South Coast Plaza. Kenny Melman and Kathleen Hanna sharing the vocal duties. Some of you will know Kenny from his role in the cabaret act Kiki and Herb, where he was Herb. And the rest of the band here with us on Soundcheck today. The screening of the film The Punk Singer, about Kathleen Hanna, will take place on Saturday evening at Doc NYC, which is part of SVA, the School of Visual Arts. It'll be released theatrically here in New York and L.A. and available on video on demand later this month on the 29th. And Kathleen's doing a DJ set at MoMA on Thursday the 21st at the Body Head Show. That's Kim Gordon's band with Bill Nace. But they're playing songs from the album Run Fast for us here on Soundcheck today. Let's hear another one. This one's called Kids in New York. Once again, it's The Julie Ruin.
Downtown artist anyway.
Sitting on the third line between Kenwood, should
just know this must be the place.
They let me hear them, they're not gonna go. It's so expensive now that they have to go hardcore.
From the chain to the deli to the coffee shop, at the beauty salon and the parking lot, up the stairs by the bus near the hardware store, on a bed to the store with the headphones on.
They let me hear them, they're not gonna go. It's so expensive now that they have to go hardcore. They let me hear them, they're not gonna go.
Kids in New York is the name of the song, live performance from the Julie Ruin here in the Soundcheck studio. Kathleen Hanna and friends performing live for us the film called The Punk Singer, a documentary about the career and life of Kathleen Hanna, is being released theatrically in New York and L.A. There'll be a screening Saturday night at SVA, part of the Doc NYC series, and featuring interviews with people like Joan Jett and Kathleen, your husband Adam, who many of our listeners will know as Ad-Rock of the Beastie Boys.
King Ad-Rock to you.
and Kathy here in the band, Kathy Wilcox, and lots of other friends and colleagues are in this film. That's got to be super weird.
It is. You know, we were talking earlier about how I have this illness that was not diagnosed for a really long time, and I archived my work, and then I, like, let someone film me for this documentary, and it's kind of like I thought I was dying, and now I'm living. And I'm like, I have to live with it all.
So have you overpromised again? Have you made the same mistake as the young Kathleen Hanna?
I didn't know. Well, I'm definitely overbooked right now. But I didn't think I would be, because I wasn't sure. I thought I would just be in bed. Like, I'd be like, I can't do anything because I'm in bed. You know, that was the last thing, was me getting interviewed for this movie and mm-hmm. finishing this record. And then
you spend the rest of your life as Mimi in La Boheme. Wasting away in a garret somewhere.
Right, exactly. Or laying in just like a really comfy, like, down bed and, like, watching Netflix. That was more my fantasy of the best scenario.
Oh, man. But, you know, one of my fantasies has always been to get you in here bopping up and down, leading a band in a live performance, which you just did here in the studio. And, Kathleen, it has been so much fun having you in the Julie Ruin, having you guys back on the scene and here in our studio today.
Thank you. You're really sweet.
Up next, we talk with photographer and filmmaker Bruce Weber, best known for his ad campaigns for Calvin Klein, music videos for Chris Isaak and the Pet Shop Boys. Back in 1988, he directed Let's Get Lost, about jazz trumpeter Chet Baker, and he joins us to talk about the 25th anniversary of that film. Plus, he'll give us a jazz-tinged Pick 3 playlist, next on Soundcheck.
That's a magic number. Yes, it is. It's the magic number.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Joining us for this week's Pick 3 is renowned fashion photographer and filmmaker Bruce Weber. On the photography side, he's known for his ad campaigns for Calvin Klein, Ralph Lauren, and more. He's also directed music videos for Chris Isaak and the Pet Shop Boys. Today, Bruce is here to talk to us more about the filmmaking side of his work. Film Forum is celebrating his career with a retrospective, which includes a 25th anniversary screening of his documentary, Let's Get Lost, focused on the tumultuous life of jazz trumpeter Chet Baker. Bruce, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks, John. It's really good to be here.
So 25 years ago, you gave us this remarkable black and white, really kind of brutally honest portrayal of Chet Baker. When's the last time you actually saw the movie?
I saw it in Venice this summer because it was celebrating its 25th year. And, you know, Chet was just, he loved living in Italy. And it was really kind of sad in a way because we always talked when we were making the film about being together at the Venice Film Festival 25 years ago mm-hmm. and showing the film the first time.
He was this remarkably good-looking, charismatic, magnetic figure in the 50s. By the time you got to him in the mid-80s, you know, life had sort of taken its toll, what we euphemistically call the rock and roll lifestyle, you know, which right. which he lived with some abandon, it seems.
You know, well, you know, Chet was funny, you know. He could rise to the occasion, and he was still very seductive. I think he always thought that he was that guy who still played with Jerry Mulligan, you know. I used to say to Chet, hey, Chet, why don't I call Jerry and, you know, and ask him to be in this film? And he'd say, oh, no, he doesn't have anything to say, you know. He never wanted another guy to be around, you know. He was funny. He always wanted to be the best-looking guy there, you know, the most talented guy, you know.
A rooster doesn't want another rooster in the hen house
exactly,
with him.
Exactly, exactly.
let's hear a clip from the film, Let's Get Lost, by my guest, Bruce Weber. Chet Baker talks about being arrested. He sets this up by talking about his doctor, you know, would take him to his gig and then bring him back home. But for this one gig, his doctor wasn't available. And he talks about his medicine. What are we talking about here? Is this methadone that he's doing at this point?
Yeah, the doctor was trying to get him on methadone, and he really made a lot of attempts to control his drug habit. And I think one of the reasons that he really loved making the film and being with us is that we were all kind of square, geeky kind of kids making this film, and none of us were high. And I don't think he would have ever joined up with us if we were.
Hmm. All right, this is Chet Baker from Bruce Weber's movie Let's Get Lost.
I stopped in a gas station to make an injection, and I was in there quite a while, and I had just finished and was, I cleaned up and was getting ready to leave, and there was a knock on the door, and it was the police. And they said, asked me if I would come with them, and they took me to the police station, and they called my doctor, and he came to the police station and got me and took me back to the clinic. And the next day, when the newspaper came out, it said that I had been found unconscious in the toilet of a gas station, that the police had to break in the door, that the room was covered in blood. I mean, completely ridiculous story.
Chet Baker from Bruce Weber's movie Let's Get Lost 25 years ago. Film Forum is doing a 25th anniversary screening this Friday evening as part of a five-night retrospective of Bruce's work, and Bruce will be introducing the movie Friday at 7 p.m. There'll be a Q&A following the screening. He's sharing a Pick 3 playlist with us today, and not surprisingly, your first pick is from the canon of Chet Baker.
Yeah, I chose this song, Autumn Leaves, because it, you know, I just love the relationship Chet had with Ruth Young. And
what was that? I mean, she's in the movie, too.
Yeah.
What was that relationship?
That relationship was completely neurotic and chaotic and crazy as only it would be. But they had a chemistry for each other. And to this day, she's still in love with him. And I imagine them doing this song. Why I always loved this song. My mom and dad, this was one of their favorite songs. But I love the way they do it because it's like they woke up at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and they're singing in their Motel 6 hotel room.
This is Chet Baker and Ruth Young with the old standard, Autumn Leaves.
The falling leaves drift by my window, deep autumn leaves of red and gold.
I see your lips, the summer kisses,
the sunburned hands I used to hold.
Since you went away, the days grow long.
Soon I'll hear your wooden song,
but I'll miss you most of all.
Chet Baker and Ruth Young with Autumn Leaves. That's a 1977 recording from the album Chet Baker Sings and Plays. And our Pick 3 playlist today coming to us from Bruce Weber here with me in the Soundcheck studio, the photographer and filmmaker. So they're releasing a box set of your films on December 3rd.
That's right.
Which will include Let's Get Lost.
Yes, definitely.
How soon after the movie opened did he die?
He died right before the movie opened. He died about 6 months before it opened in Venice.
While you were making the movie, did you have any intimations of his impending mortality? I mean, he was a mess by the end of his life.
Well, you know, John, you know, Chet kept saying, you know, people said that I died, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. There's always reports in the newspaper. And we really felt that he would outlive all of us.
Yeah, yeah. So Chet Baker, the first on your Pick 3 for us on Soundcheck today. The second is Robert Mitchum. Now, you're making a movie about him as well, right?
Well, I'm making a movie about Bob. You know, I wanted to always make a film about an actor. And I thought, well, maybe I'll pick Jimmy Stewart, maybe Gregory Peck. But I sort of ended up with Bob because he was my favorite actor. He was Chet's favorite actor. He was my dad's favorite actor. And so I sort of ended up, you know, thinking, okay, you know, Bob's a good actor to make a film on. Little did I know that he was more of a character than Chet. And Chet and I used to sit around and talk about his films all the time, and he'd laugh and he'd get really involved in Bob's character and everything. And, you know, Bob was a singer as well. He always wanted to be a singer. He was good friends with Pearl Bailey. Sinatra was one of his best friends. And when we were filming Bob, we went over to Capitol Records in L.A., where Sinatra used to do all his music. And I rented that same space there. I think it's Studio B, I think. And I said, Bob, this is where you did your Calypso album. And he said, yeah, so, you know. And all the musicians, I've chosen really good musicians to play with him for the recordings that we were doing. We had Marianne Faithfull with us and Dr. John and Ricky Lee Jones, you know.
Wow.
And it seemed to me a place where a lot of people really open up in song and in music when they normally don't, just talking about their own life. And you can find things out about them. Listening to Chet sing this, it's no different than Bob in a way, or even Julie London, the other person I chose. You really feel a little essence of who they are.
Have you seen the Harry Dean Stanton documentary? Because he actually sings at various points through the documentary, and he's like this closed book, you know, when you're just kind of talking to him. And then when he sings, it's like there's a door opening or something.
That's why we did the music in Bob's, to really open that door. It's funny how it happened, you know. Bob kept saying to me, you know, I don't have the sheet music. I never got this. I sent it to him. The arranger sent it to him. You know, my assistant director sent it to him. But then when we recorded him, he started singing right away.
Mm-hmm. So he, like Chet Baker, had a certain bad boy image. Was it as well-deserved as Chet Baker's?
I have to say that Bob, in his own quiet way, gave Chet a run for his money.
The title for your forthcoming documentary about Robert Mitchum is somewhat provocative. Nice Girls Don't Stay for Breakfast.
Well, John, you know, that titles come to you in a crazy way. I was in Norway, and it was in the summer, so the light was up till 2, 3 in the morning, which I'd love because it could be up all night photographing. And I finally went to bed about 3, and I couldn't really go to sleep because I was thinking about the photographs we did and the ones we're going to do. And I'm laying there, and this radio station had Julie London singing that song. And I'm a huge Julie London fan. I met her. I had this amazing experience with her and her husband, Bobby Troup. And so I started, you know, I thought, oh, that's the most perfect song for Bob. He would really dig that.
Well, so that is the name, Nice Girls Don't Stay for Breakfast, of Bruce Weber's upcoming documentary about Robert Mitchum, the actor and singer. Now, you mentioned his Calypso record. This is a track from that Robert Mitchum record called They Dance All Night.
Ah, Creole gal, how you love your bacchanal. Ah, you see them Creole gal, boy, how they love their bacchanal. I mean, they move their hips in a funny way, dance all night and sleep all day. Then they start up polishing, lordy lord, how they love romancing. When you see them on the street, they got their rhythm in their feet. Yes, they are born Creole, they got their rhythm in their soul. I mean, they move their hips in a funny way, dance all night and sleep all day. Then they start up polishing, lordy lord, how they love romancing.
That is Robert Mitchum from his 1957 album, Calypso Is Like So... And picked for us by Bruce Weber, the filmmaker and photographer whose works are being celebrated beginning this weekend at Film Forum here in Manhattan with a screening of his Chet Baker documentary, Let's Get Lost, on Friday evening. The upcoming documentary focused on Robert Mitchum will be called Nice Girls Don't Stay for Breakfast. That song, by the way, picked for us by Bruce, is called They Dance All Night. You talked about setting him up in a studio for this documentary.
That's right.
Did you pick the songs?
I picked the songs, and John Lefwich, who's the ranger, picked them. And then Ricky Lee Jones had picked some, and Dr. John did. Bob didn't really care. I mean, he really adored Johnny Mercer. He was a really close friend of his. And he loved all his songs. I mean, he sings at the beginning of the film a song which I had never heard called But in the Morning, No.
Okay.
And it's quite amusing.
Now, you mentioned with the title Nice Girls Don't Stay for Breakfast that you actually heard Julie London sing that song.
And yeah, that's
so
right.
So you knew Julie London.
Well, I met her in a really strange way. It was years before that, and I was going to school here at NYU, and me and a buddy of mine had these two dates, these kind of uptight girls from Greenwich, Connecticut, and we went to hear Julie London perform, and we had fake IDs, and we were sitting in a bar up at this the Americana Hotel, you know? But we had suits on, you know, but kind of preppy ties, and we were drinking some scotch and stuff, and this guy in the suit comes up with dark glasses, and he goes, "What are you guys doing here? How old are you?" And we thought, oh, great, we've been busted. You know, we're going to call our parents and tell us to
How
come
old
and
were
bail
you?
Us out. We were like 17, 16,
okay,
17.
All right. 18 was drinking age
yeah,
back
right.
then. So.
And I said, well, I'm just the biggest Julie London fan. And he said, well, my name is Bobby Troup and I'm her husband. He says, why don't you guys come up to the room after the show and we're giving a little party. So we were like fainting, you know, and we thought this was so great. And the girl said, oh, we can't trust that guy. He's in a nightclub and he's wearing sunglasses. And I said, Bobby Troup's this great arranger. And he's been with Julie London since she was with Jack Webb. And he's a really cool guy. We're going to go. Anyway, Julie London came on stage. She looked really amazing. She was very, very drunk. It was a late show. So the show was over about 1:30, and we storm up to the room, and we knock on the door, and we're a nervous wreck, and we knock on it, and she opens it, and you can't imagine what she was wearing. She was wearing a red teddy nightgown. We almost fainted. She said, come on in, kids, come on in. Let me get you a drink, and let's hang in the kitchen. All the other guys are playing poker.
Wow. So that was your run-in with Julie London.
She was really great to us and really sweetheart and sexy and wonderful.
And getting you in the Christmas spirit, apparently, because the song you've picked to round out your pick three for us is I'd Like You for Christmas. Where's this song from?
I think it was printed in England, and I'd never heard it before, but I love how, you know, her sense of humor with things was always really great in her music. And Bob just adored her music too.
Bob Mitchum.
Yeah. So I really felt like, oh, I wanted to choose this song because of that.
So there's been a nice little chain passing along here, you know, Chet Baker and you talking about Bob Mitchum, and then Bob Mitchum liking Julie London. So.
Yeah, and even the first film I made, Broken Noses, which will appear at the Film Forum this weekend too, which is my first documentary, Julie sings in that, you know.
Yeah. Bruce Weber has been presenting a playlist for us on our recurring Pick 3 feature, and the retrospective of his work at Film Forum begins Friday night with a screening of Let's Get Lost. If you want all the details, there's a lot happening. Go to our website, soundcheck.org, and you'll find a link there. Bruce, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's really fun talking about these old friends. I really had a good time.
Julie London recorded this song in 1957. It's called I'd Like You for Christmas.
I'd like you for Christmas. Please make my wish come true. 'Cause I'd trim trees and deck the hallways if I knew you. Be mine for always. I won't be blue on Christmas if old Saint Nick comes through and he remembers that I'd like you for Christmas, New Year's Eve.
Up next, we hear about the latest battle being waged in the digital music copyright wars, and it has nothing to do with illegal downloads. Our soundcheck copyright superhero, the Copycat, explains right after the break. They say there are 8 million stories in the Naked City. This is one of them. Sure, it's a crime story, but this one's kind of complicated. Intellectual property. That's right, baby. Copyright. Trademarks. What happens when the public domain gets a little too public? To explain it, you need someone who knows the law. To some, he's a mild-mannered attorney. But to us, he's the Copycat. The Copycat is Jonathan Reichman, partner at the intellectual property law firm of Kenyon & Kenyon, LLP, and our trusted guide when it comes to copyright law. Welcome back, John.
Thank you, John.
So we've summoned you in your role as Copycat today to talk about lyrics. We're not talking about someone singing another person's lyrics. We're talking about those websites where if you want to know the lyrics to a song, you type in the name of the song plus lyrics, and it gives it to you, right?
Yes, yes.
So how does that infringe upon copyright?
Well, let's start out with the fact that the song itself is a copyrighted work, and the copyrighted work consists of both the music and the lyrics, two equal components, each entitled to copyright protection. And what these websites are doing is they're posting the lyrics on their websites, making them very accessible, but they're doing it without having gotten any license or permission or paid any royalty whatsoever to the copyright owner, namely the music publishers.
Now, but these sites have been around for years. I mean, you know, this genie has been out of the bottle for a long time.
Yeah, that's true, but I think what's going on here is they've become more and more popular. And the music publishers have noticed that they're starting to attract advertising, so they've really become a business. And the publishers feel that these websites are now making money off of their lyrics.
Okay. So now that there's money to be made, the publishers want their cut. Do some of these lyric websites actually already license the lyrics? Are some of them doing it above board and completely legal?
Yes, I believe that there's a number of them out there that have entered into blanket licensing arrangements with the major music publishers, either directly or through their agents. So they're fine. They can continue to do it. It's the others, which I think are probably the vast majority of them, that are operating on an unlicensed basis.
Okay, and these are the ones that the National Music Publishers Association is going after, announcing that they're filing takedown notices on these unlicensed sites. And John, I looked at their list of the top 50 sites that are doing this illegally, and I noticed not just, you know, the expected sites like lyricsmania.com and elyricsworld.com, but a bunch of music, like chord sites, you know, where if you play guitar and you want to know what the chords are for a song, those are on this list as well. Is that also copyright infringement when you tell somebody this song consists of C, F, A, and A minor?
Yes, potentially. You know, it's an interesting thing because they're not; those sites are not actually reproducing the full melody or the lyrics or the song in toto completely. But they're creating, I would say, a derivative work based upon those melodies by giving the user of the website all of the chords. So I think that would fall within the boundaries of infringement, too.
Well, but I think some people would say that, you know, this is sort of almost like fan funding. You know, it's like it's guitarists saying, I think the chords go like this, and putting that up. And then someone else might say, no, I don't think that's a B minor. I think it's a B minor 7 or something like that. And this gets us to the number one website on the music publisher's hit list, which is rapgenius.com, which Rap Genius claims to be exactly that, a kind of, you know, fan-driven hip-hop Wikipedia thing.
Yes, it's actually, they raise a very interesting defense. You know, the sort of automatic defense that you think of in this type of situation is fair use, because the copyright law allows unpermitted, unlicensed uses if you're doing it in a way that comments on or transforms the copyrighted work into something else. And what Rap Genius is saying is that they're putting out these lyrics and then fans sort of build new material around it through commentary, through blogs, through arguments back and forth. I think it's frankly a creative argument. I don't think it's the typical fair use situation, because in the typical fair use situation, the person who initially puts it out there also provides the commentary and the interpretation. So to me, this is another really interesting example of where the internet is a new technology that's forcing us to reassess and readdress traditional copyright law doctrines.
All right. In your role as the copycat and as a lawyer, what do you think of that Rap Genius defense that, you know, we're not just putting lyrics up there. It's about, you know, scholarly debate or satire, you know, satirical commentary on said lyrics, et cetera.
I've thought about it, and I think on balance, I would say that defense should not be successful. Now, I admit I'm a copyright traditionalist. I'm you know, kind of old school in some respects. But to me, the situation where that type of commentary should justify and support a fair use defense is where the person who puts it out there, as I said before, is the one who creates the new material. Here, Rap Genius is just sitting back, letting all these people do it for them. They're sort of saying, we're like Wikipedia.
Exactly.
You know, we put an article out there, and then we allow the world to comment on it. But Wikipedia is different. Wikipedia is putting out factual material on different subjects. They're not putting out creative works like songs that they didn't originate.
All right. So do you think that some of these 50 sites that the National Music Publishers Association, do you think most of these sites will either get taken down or have to, you know, get legal and go for a blanket license?
Yeah, so I expect a lot of them will just voluntarily shut down. If they do get sued by the Publishers Association, I think they will probably quickly settle. You know, a lot of these sites probably don't have the financial resources to undertake a major defense against the music publishing industry.
We've been speaking with Jonathan Reichman, the copycat. He is a partner at Kenyon & Kenyon LLP. John, nice speaking with you again.
Thank you, John. Nice to talk with you.
That's going to do it for Soundcheck today. Tomorrow on the show, we talk with the author of a new biography about the legendary dancer, director, and choreographer Bob Fosse. And we learn a surprising fact about cochlear implants. They can't hear music. at least not the way those of us in the non-deaf community hear it. We'll find out why and what the latest research is doing to change that. Plus, the band Princess Music was named by a 3-year-old, but their music is for all ages. We'll hear a live performance from this Colorado chamber pop band in our studio. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop and Mike Katziff with Isaac Davey Aronson and Amy Pearl, and our intern Alex Martinez. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer, and this is Soundcheck.